Accession number 19095, Reel 1.
Alan Hiscock, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Atherstone, in Warwickshire.
Which year was this?
1921.
Did you grow up and have your education in Atherstone?
Yes, I did, until I went away to school at Worcester.
How old were you when you finished your education?
I was nearly 18.
So that would have been in 39?
Yes.
Before or after the war started?
Before the war started. Well, at the... Before the war actually started.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did, yes.
Under what circumstances?
I was staying... I had just returned from Germany, and I was staying with my grandparents in London.
What had taken you to Germany?
A school friend and I wanted to go and have a look at Germany because of the clear imminence of war, and we thought it would be our last chance to see Germany without a war being actually in progress. In fact, we only got out of Germany by the skin of our teeth, and the war against Poland had already started. And one of the interesting things about our presence in Berlin at that time was a number of German refugees fleeing from the Polish frontier. I think that is one of the very few times that people have seen German refugees fleeing from a battlefront. Normally, of course, it is the other way around, and we have seen refugees from all over Europe fleeing in front of German invaders.
What did they look like?
Just like refugees anywhere else, with packs and bags and bundles of clothing and so on. It was really quite an interesting time.
Did they seem in a distressed condition?
I'm not quite sure. This was mainly at the Zoological Garden Station in Berlin that we saw these refugees. And, of course, it was the first time either of us had seen refugees, so we weren't quite sure what to expect.
Did somebody tell you that they were refugees?
Oh yes, we were able to establish that very quickly.
And so this was just a summer holiday in Berlin, was it?
Yes, and all over Germany, actually. Over, we went over quite a wide area of Germany, including Fulda and so on. And we came out through Belgium, and the train was absolutely packed with refugees, very largely Jewish refugees, that they themselves told us who they were. The trains were absolutely packed solid. And we were sometimes kept at night in railway stations while the enormous quantity of German equipment was being ferried to the front. That was the front that became a front shortly afterwards. It was amazing to see the quantity of equipment which the Germans were shifting onto the Belgian frontier.
Anything else you can tell me about the Jewish refugees?
No, I don't think so, other than the fact that we were with them on the various trains that we caught, and they were very open in saying who they were. and they were very glad to be able to get out of Germany. Of course, many didn't. And indeed, we searched after the war for the landlady of a lodging house that we stayed in. That we stayed in Cologne, but she had been taken away and evaporated, I think, in the terms of the war, in what was happening.
What kind of impression of German life did you get whilst you were there?
Well, everywhere we saw brown shirts and a few black shirts. The brown shirts were often carousing and making a noise in the various bars and inns, and we had a very poor impression of them, I must say. The black shirts, on the other hand, kept themselves to themselves rather more and were clearly a more well-educated lot of people. But it was very interesting to see the marching about that was going on, especially the brown shirts marching with their bands up and down the streets. And funnily enough, many years later, I stayed in a hotel on the Rhine and I saw the same kind of marching band and followers as I'd seen in the war. I'm talking now about the 1970s. So it was obviously a part of German culture to march about behind bangs.
How were you treated by the German population and authorities?
Very well, because we were English. They had no quarrel with us. I think they rather hoped we would remain very, very much on their side in the case of conflict. And of course, we were young men with our hair cut short in the fashion of the times, and I think that we were looked at fairly favourably.
Did you have any instances of tension or conflict?
No, none at all, interestingly enough. Mind you, at certain times we didn't speak very much in English, but they didn't seem to have any objection to the English. I think they still hoped that we would not be drawn into the war against them.
And you visited Berlin and Fulda?
Yes, and Cologne, of course, and one or two other cities. We came out through the Ruhr, and it was in the Ruhr that we saw the enormous numbers of trains loaded with equipment. And of course, one of the interesting things was, as you went through Germany in those days, the people working in the fields would see the train and they would stand up and wave their calling up papers to the people on the train, who would wave back. It was very interesting to see that. I've never forgotten it. It impressed me very much.
Why should they have done that?
Well, to show that they were part of the Reich, and they were going to go and join up too, and this was their way of showing their loyalty to the nation, I suppose.
Any other memories you've got of Germany at that time?
Yes. The extraordinary habit that had risen up, that had grown up in Nazi Germany, in the youth hostels. If you stayed in a youth hostel, every night you had to be in bed strictly by 10 o'clock, I think. And everybody had to listen to the local Führer walking up and down the the between the beds in the youth hostel and declaiming the virtues of the Nazi regime and so on. Very, very interesting to see that. I never heard anybody else describe that, although many English must have seen it. Very, very interesting. And we were treated just like the German youth, of course. They didn't say anything specially to us. It was all for the German youth.
Did it seem a free or a regimented society?
Very much regimented.
In what sense?
In that there was, for instance, as I described in the youth hostels, there were the brown shirt youth leaders and so on. And every night, of course, there was a flag lowering party and all this sort of militaristic, jingoistic behaviour everywhere. And the brown shirts, as I say, marching about. That gave an impression of a very structured and militaristic society.
So you were there just a few weeks?
Yes, for a month or two. And we came back just before war was declared by Neville Chamberlain.
Was there a change in attitude towards you after the outbreak of the German-Polish War?
No, not at all. Although we didn't go about saying that in a loud voice that we are Brits and we don't approve or anything like that. We kept quiet and watched and talked to the people, you know.
How did you feel when you heard the news of Chamberlain's declaration of war?
Well, we felt it was coming anyway. We were, I think, like all young people in those days, we were sure that war would break out with Germany.
Did you have any political feelings yourself at the time?
Yes. I felt that it was inevitable that there should be a war.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not really. I was a bit. My career that I had looked forward to was going to the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich, and hence into the Royal Engineers. But as soon as the war broke out, the recruitment into the Royal Military Academy was put back, and so I had to wait until early 41 before I was actually in the army.
What were you doing in the 39-41 period?
Well, I went to Birmingham University and to do civil engineering, and I joined the University Cadet Corps, and that, of course, was an important step for me to pursue my main career subsequently.
So you were living in Birmingham?
I was living in Atherstone, actually, then, but commuting to Birmingham.
How far is Atherstone from Birmingham?
Oh, it's about 18, 20 miles, something like that, or a bit less.
Did you experience any bombing of the Midlands by the German Air Force in that period?
There was a lot of bombing of Coventry and Birmingham, none of the little town where I lived, but it was very marked, the bombing of Coventry and a lot of other bombings in Birmingham as well, and everybody was very concerned and involved in that, including my father, for instance, who was a senior special constabulary. He was a senior officer in the special constabulary and was out a great deal attending to the various problems arising from the bombing, refugees and so on. Or not refugees, but helping the population.
Did any bombs fall near you?
No, not very near, oddly enough. Although they fell near me when I was in Birmingham.
They fell near you in Birmingham?
Well, you know, when one was coming and going. And I did live in Birmingham for a short time.
How did public morale stand up to the bombing in Birmingham?
I think very well. I don't recall any particular despondency caused by it. It was just people were sorry that it happened and would do their best to make sure that we held our own against the Germans.
Was there any damage in the Birmingham University area?
Not as I remember, no.
Was life for students or the staff at Birmingham much affected by the war at that
time? Not at the beginning, no. Of course, later it was a different matter. And I don't know what happened later because I was off myself.
Were you studying engineering?
Yes, I was, yes.
Can you tell me about joining the army, please?
Well, I was... I had already, before the outbreak of the war, registered my intention of going to the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich. And I was exempt from examinations because of my various higher school certificates that I had. And so I merely had to wait until I was the right age to be accepted as an officer cadet. So I went to an officer cadet training unit in January 1941, whereas I should have gone to the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich in 1940 or 1939. So it just delayed me by a year or so. So I went to the university in order to fill up that time.
And what was the next step?
I joined the officer cadet training unit at Aldershot, and after being commissioned in the middle of 1941, I eventually went out to India on a troop ship and joined King George V's own Bengal sappers and miners at Roorkee in the United Provinces.
What was the voyage out like?
Well, we were part of a convoy with reinforcements for Far East, for India and the Far East, and replacements and so on and so forth. And funnily enough, there was a retired major of Royal Engineers who was looking after our particular batch of young officers. And he was a martinet, in a sense, in that we had to learn to speak Urdu before we got to India. And every single day we practiced this Urdu, and it was very effective, because by the time we got to our units in India, where they spoke Urdu, we had all been given a good grounding. So I'm forever grateful to that that senior officer who did that.
Which ship did you go in?
I beg your pardon?
Which ship did you go in?
Otranto, I think it was. And the accommodation was crowded, but the discipline was good and food was good and so on. And we were bunked together in a very small space, but of course the troops had even less space. We had, as young officers, we had a little bit more breathing space. but the soldiers didn't have quite as much as us, although, you know, everybody was all compressed in a small space. But the ship itself was well managed, and the food was good, and we weren't torpedoed, although we had many flaps, and the ship actually went across the South Atlantic off Brazil in order to escape the attention of the German raiders. But we eventually landed in Bombay, and from there went by train to our various destinations, mine being Roorkee.
What were your first impressions of India?
It was as I had expected, because we had all read up what we were going to do, and we have had it, our life was explained by the various people who had been there before, including the senior officer who made us all learn Urdu quite properly. And so when we got to India, we didn't find it totally a strange place, although the noise and movement everywhere was absolutely amazing. In some senses, India being so full of people wandering about and walking about and talking, and the noise in the bazaars and all those sort of things were really, despite our reading and our instruction, was really quite an eye-opener to us to see this great continent and all its people.
What happened to you at Roorkee?
Well, we were given more instruction about our soldiers, who of course were Sikhs, Hindus, and Punjabi Muslims. And the Bengal Sappers and Miners, despite its name, had recruited from those three, in general, they'd recruited from those three races or religions in India. And they had, of course, been trained from the depot at Roorkee from the time of the Indian Mutiny. So the whole place, and the whole of Roorkee, where the headquarters and depot was beautifully tidy and arranged, and we were welcomed there by the existing people, and then we got to learn something about our own soldiers that we would have. For instance, we were encouraged to take part in visiting the Sikh Gurdwara, you know what a Gurdwara is, and thereby became used to listening and looking and talking to the people who we would eventually be responsible for. So all that was quite busy, and we learned about the soldiers that we would have. And we learned to speak to them in their own language. It was absolutely forbidden for any British officer to speak English either to one of the soldiers or to his own brother officers before 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you really got your ear pulled if anybody heard you speaking English before that time. It was very good discipline for us.
Did you obey that order?
Yes, oh yes. And it was, one perceived that it was a good thing, and so we did, and people did obey that. And after 2 o'clock, of course, you could speak to your brother officers in English, but you still were not allowed to speak to your Indian soldiers in English. That was discouraged at all times. Uh, and
where is Roque?
It is in the United Provinces in northern India. It's an open plain land, and that itself was an interesting place because one could cycle around and go to the villages and talk to the people and so on.
What kind of reception did you get from Indian civilians?
Well, in that part of the world, very good reception. But of course, it was before the uprisings, which later happened as the Japanese war progressed. So there was a great deal of unrest in India, which I personally did not see very much of, because by that time I was in Burma.
So we're talking about the second half of 1941, are we?
Yes, in the latter part of 1941, I was in Roorkee, and then units were being formed up to be sent either to the Middle East or to the Far East, and I joined a unit, a field company of sappers and miners, together with some other young officers like myself.
Did it have a letter or a number, this field company?
70, yes, it was 70 field company, Bengal sappers and miners, commanded by a Major Lyle Grant, who later became a Major General, and who has written two very good books on the subject. He was a very good OC. And so anyway, the 70 Field Company was formed up and given some training, and eventually we went off to Madras, catching the train at Roorkee, and it was very interesting to see all the soldiers' wives and children and everybody all waving us goodbye as we went off to the war with a great deal of enthusiasm. Anyway, we embarked in Madras on a very old steamship and landed in Rangoon just very early in March, just after the disaster of the Satang Bridge, which happened. That disaster was late in February, and we arrived in Rangoon on the 3rd of March.
How had your soldiers viewed going to Burma?
Well, that was part of their lives. They knew that they would be going somewhere to war. Don't forget, they're all volunteers. There are no press men in the Indian Army. And by tradition, they were from warrior races and looked forward to taking part.